You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
These papers are all just a piece of the many, many companies that are being put into trust to be run by my two sons. And I hope at the end of 8 years, I'll come back and I'll say, oh, you did a good job. Otherwise, if they do a bad job, I'll say, you're fired. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
Donald Trump gives his first press conference since being elected America's president. My guests Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Alistair Bunkle from Sky News are here to pore over what Trump said, what he didn't say, and what it all means. Plus, the future of political moderation in Iran, Xi Jinping's trip to Davos, and we'll ask what happens when North Korea shoots an ICBM at the US. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Alistair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News, and Raffaello Pantucci, director of international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Alistair and Raffaello, thank you very much for joining us today. A little earlier, Donald Trump held his first press conference in 6 months, the first since he was elected as president in November. Amongst other things, Trump discussed the issue of his alleged conflicts of interest, said the country doesn't care about his tax returns, pledged to repeal and replace Obamacare, criticised his many and varied detractors, and of course, sort of, talked about Russia and the various allegations swirling around him. Alistair Bunkle, I'll begin with you. It was a rather surreal press conference, wasn't it?
Yeah, how long have we got? I mean, it finished about half an hour ago, and it was bizarre from start to finish. I mean, it was the most extraordinary press conference I've probably ever seen and heard, in so much that he even went away for a period of time and then came back again and started taking questions. There are any number of news lines that you could have taken out of it, but it really just went off the rails when he started to get into a shouting match with a CNN correspondent. He described BuzzFeed as being a failing pile of garbage. He accused CNN of being fake news. The CNN correspondent then stood up and demanded that he have a right of reply and wanted a question. Trump told him to sit down, stop being impolite. And every time that it went to the floor to ask questions, there was this huge kind of hum of reporters wanting to have their say. But essentially, he covered a number of areas that we've all been wanting to ask him for the last month or so since he was elected and prior to his inauguration.
I want to come on to the media aspect of this in a moment. But Raffaello, first of all, let's look at these issues over Russia. And Donald Trump has been very firm in saying that, up until now, that he believed the reports from the US intelligence agencies about Russian involvement in hacking, that Vladimir Putin had ordered it, that it had had an impact on the election. He's been absolutely clear that this was nonsense, and often cited as proof that it was nonsense, the fact that Russia said it wasn't true. We then had today this issue of this dossier, which hasn't been put forward by the CIA or the FBI or anyone else. It's a private document. And that has, in a sense, allowed him to sort of say, well, look, see, lots of this stuff really isn't true.
I mean, I think the Russia part of the story is very complicated and different in many different ways. I think on the one hand, whenever you've seen him comment on it, he's often focused very much on the idea that the elections and his sort of election as president was undermined by this, and the sort of validity of it isn't quite real because what the Russians were doing was sort of meddling with election machines and all these sorts of things, and that somehow throws into question him actually being president or not. And that's often what he's sort of focused on, which is slightly different in some ways to accusations that the Russians hack, which, you know, they do, and I think we've seen a lot of convincing evidence around it. He's questioned some of the assertions, and in fact, if you look at the way that the sort of The intelligence community document that was released focuses in particular on the links back to Putin himself directing it. They do hedge. Mm. You know, they do hedge. It doesn't sound like they've got someone on record somewhere who said, you know, Vladimir said to me, then go hack them and do this, that and the other. You know, I think it's part of a bigger picture and they're sort of fitting it into that. So they have hedged. So in some ways, one could kind of read into that and say, actually, what he's focusing on is one part of it. And there's a whole bunch of other things that maybe he's not actually thrown into question, but it's all getting sort of caught up with themselves. On the other side of the equation, the other part, which is interesting, and I think, you know, I unfortunately missed this press conference, though. From all accounts, it sounds like it was very good fun to watch.
You've got to go back and watch it.
I think I am. I was looking for it on Twitter before. I'm sure it's somewhere there. But if I've understood correctly, on that, he was asked about this reset with the Russians. And he said, no, we don't need a reset. We just need to have good relationships with the Russians. And if we don't, well, life will go. We will move on anyway, which I think says a lot, you know. And I think it does speak to the fact that, you know, there is a reality to this. And I think that, you know, every American president's come into office, be it Bush, be it Obama, came in and started with a reset with the Russians. Then it all went wrong because the Russians actually have a whole different agenda they're advancing. And so I think he's kind of leaving it open that he could end up playing in that direction as well.
I'm really intrigued to see how he will play the Russian factor. I mean, he's appointed a Secretary of State who's got close relationships with Vladimir Putin. As you say, we were chatting about this beforehand. Mm. Every American president thinks they can better their relationships with Russia. And yet I read a really interesting article in Politico we were talking about as well, where they said, like, it doesn't matter who the president is, basically. The fact is that Putin's Russia, to survive and thrive, requires conflict with the United States, if not actual conflict, you know, a sort of a conflict of dialogue, if you like, a conflict of ideologies. So if that remains the case, and if Trump fails in his attempts to try and have sort of cordial relationships with Russia, how will he then approach it? Because Obama sort of was a bit standoffish. Trump's all mouth. Will that actually turn into action?
And I mean, even these discussions around Tillerson. I mean, I think Tillerson, you know, he was the head of a company which looks for oil and gas around the world. Russia is a place that has a lot of these things. So, of course, he's going to try to find ways to have friendships with the leadership. I don't think that means he's necessarily a, you know, a fluent Russian speaker and a great lover of Vladimir Putin and willing to his best pal. You know?
What was interesting today in the other, you know, which is a bit of a sideshow, really, but the other main event in the US today, certainly in Washington, was the hearings for Secretary of State to be, Rex Tillerson, where Alistair Bunkle, he talked about, he came out far stronger against Russia than people might have suspected in the past, and also far stronger than his would-be boss, Donald Trump. He said, yes, you know, Russia did go into Ukraine. Yes, it did take Crimea, and it shouldn't have. It did talk. He did talk about what Putin had been doing in Syria, refused to accept that Putin was a war criminal, which led to Marco Rubio saying, let me tell you about Aleppo. But there did seem to be, it seemed as if he was trying to rebut those allegations that he was too friendly to Putin.
Yeah, and just to go back to Trump, who has admitted in this press conference that Russia was behind some hacking in the election, asked what would you say to Vladimir Putin as a response, and said, you know, you shouldn't have done that. You won't do it again. I mean, you're like, you're ticking off a small child. Tillerson admitted that some European countries have reason to fear Russia, and that plays into the whole NATO question. And I do think that since Donald Trump's election, regardless of what he said during the campaign when he questioned the commitment from some NATO states, he, I think, described it as quote-unquote obsolete as an alliance. I think since there has been an effort within his administration, I include within that the sort of the wider administration to be, an attempt to sort of reassure NATO allies, actually, no, America is a part of NATO.
And yet, you know, if you were watching that press conference, Ruffalo, you would have seen him talking about how, well, you know, if Putin thinks I'm a good guy, that's an asset. It's a strange situation, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is. But then again, you know, I think the question is, what ultimately are they going to do with this? What ultimately is the sort of end goal? How is he going to negotiate? What is he going to negotiate with him? And how is he going to get to some result? He's not entirely wrong. You know, if the other side likes you and has some sort of a personal warm feeling towards you, that will undoubtedly help in your discussions, as long as you're able to realize that they may be pandering to you to try to sort of manipulate in some way. And that's the part that's not totally clear. How much is he able to sort of realize when he's being played, or how much is he able to take advantage of these sorts of relationships he has to be able to advance goals, national American goals.
Now, one other thing, Alistair, which came up in this press conference, which is new, was Trump's attempts to deal with the issues surrounding conflicts of interest. Mm. There are all sorts of things that have been raised to do with what his family is going to be doing, how much control he's going to have over his company, what international deals he may or may not be doing. And there were some bizarre things that came up. Let's start with the bit where he proudly said he turned down a $2 billion offer from someone in Dubai. Now, you know, if he had accepted a $2 billion offer of a deal in Dubai, that surely would have been a massive conflict of interest.
He's not yet president, which I think was his sort of argument, that I'm not yet president, so I could have taken that deal if I'd wanted to. By the way, for the record, I will take that deal if it's still open to anyone. He is, I'm no businessman or economist, so how he is diversifying or pushing away his companies in order to avoid that conflict of interest, I'm not sure of the validity of what he is putting in place. Although at this press conference, he had bundles and bundles of papers on the table in front of him.
Do we think that those had real documents in them? Or someone had just gone to the printer and be like, just stick it full of A4, yeah, it's fine.
Half of them were probably blank, but he was saying, look, here you go in front of me. These are some of my business interests and this is kind of what we're going to do with them. It is up to the accountants, the forensics out there to sort of work out whether what he is doing distances the president from these massive business interests. But Donald Trump's message to the wider people who don't have that kind of analytical brain is, you kind of just got to trust me.
Rafael Pantucci, if you had to make a bet on who would be first to lose their job over a potential Trump conflict of interest business deal, you would probably say it's going to be a politician in another country.
Possibly. I don't know. I think I wonder very much about some of his family who are being employed, apparently, in the administration. There's been a lot of coverage around Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's now been sort of brought in as a sort of senior advisor to him, who's also not only, you know, part of the sort of Trump clan, but also has his own separate business interests that are really quite substantial. So I wouldn't be surprised if he managed to find himself falling into some trouble or some sort of conflict of interest sooner maybe than some sort of foreign leader who Trump may be dealing with. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, I think Trump ultimately can look at all this and say, you know what, it doesn't matter, because everyone in the United States who voted for him knew that he had these business interests and they were willing to vote for him nonetheless. And so he feels he obviously has a public mandate to support him to go ahead and do these things. And frankly, I think he will continue to act like this and just sort of ignore it and move on.
Well, he kept on saying whenever anyone challenged him on this was, well, I won, so it's okay.
But the media, I mean, let us not forget, I mean, you know, I sit here, and likewise you, Steve, as members of the media, Raf not so much, but one who engages in the media or with the media a lot, and, you know, and you're up in arms about the way he sort of conducts himself, refusing to give CNN a question, insulting BuzzFeed, etc. The fact is, the media in America isn't that popular. A lot of us will look at it and we will, you know, laugh slightly fearfully about this kind of press conference being a sort of some sort of West End show, Broadway show type thing. But a lot of people would have looked at that in America and loved what they were hearing. Yeah.
But that's a problem, though, isn't it? The fact that you've got CNN, we're not talking about some fringe website, but even frankly, if we were, you know, who are not allowed to ask a question at a press conference, are shouted down and abused by president-elect. Then it turns out afterwards have been told by his spokesman that if he ever tries to ask a question like that again, he'll be thrown out and won't be allowed back in. This is the sort of thing that happens in, you know, in undemocratic states.
It happens here occasionally. I should say. I mean, it has happened in this country before. It occasionally happens with leaders around the world. It often happens when leaders feel vulnerable that they then fall out with the press, or they feel that the press are in any way setting the agenda. Of course it's worrying. If the media en masse turns against you, I think eventually your downfall will come about.
I mean, I think it's worrying, but then I would also say, I would echo exactly what Alistair said and say, I remember seeing, it was a month ago or sometime around that, that there was a press conference at the State Department where the spokesman, John Kirby, got into a shouting match with a Russia Today reporter that was there, and she was ejected from the room in not unsimilar terms and confronted in a very similar way. So I think if you were a person who's not involved in the media, doesn't have those sorts of views, you would look and say, well, how is this necessarily different? And maybe this is just how you have to treat the media. I agree it's not healthy to have this sort of a confrontational relationship between the sort of power and the media. I mean, you do need some sort of attention there, but I think it can go too far. But I do also think that the general public in the States won't necessarily look at it with the same sort of concern that we might.
Okay, let's move on now and take a much-needed pause from Donald Trump and turn to Iran. Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, one of the founders of the Islamic Republic, died on Sunday at the age of 82. In his later years, Rafsanjani cooled his revolutionary zeal and became a supporter of political moderation in the country. And for that reason, the current president, Hassan Rouhani, may be missing his former ally. Rafsanjani played a role in Rouhani's election in 2013 and would have likely played a similar role in the upcoming elections this summer. Alistair Bunkle, Hassan Rouhani is probably running for re-election, although when it comes to Iranian politics, no one is ever entirely clear which candidates are going to make it through the vetting procedure. Is he strong enough on his own to, and has a strong enough record over the past 4 years to survive without having a mentor like Rafsanjani around?
Well, Rouhani would try and sort of sit in the middle between sort of his newfound friends, the reformists, and the hardliners on the right who are opposed to a sort of an advance in a sort of liberal Iran, if you like. In some ways, I think, assuming Rouhani stands for re-election in June, this will be a referendum on the nuclear deal, because it will be the first time that the country en masse has had an ability, and of course the country's political and religious leaders have had the ability to sort of, in a plebiscite, have their say on the Iranian deal. And that, again, you know, dare I say, it comes back to Trump and how he decides to play Iran in his presidency. Whether or not the Ayatollah Khamenei will side with Rouhani, my gut feeling is he will in the end, but I don't think he'll play quite the sort of, I'm hesitant to call Rafsanjani the kingmaker, but he was the supporter of Rouhani in 2013, and he was very influential in what happened.
And I guess, Rafael, it's important to point out as well that, yeah, I refer to political moderation and occasionally to Rouhani as a moderate, but that's within a rather sort of narrow bandwidth. He was the most moderate, in inverted commas, of all those who were allowed to stand. There were many, you know, would-be reformers who didn't get anywhere near the ballot.
Yes, but then also he'd been around since the beginning of the revolution. He's sort of one of these big godlike figures. He was one of these sort of big figures within sort of Iranian politics. So Rafsanjani had that different kind of a role. I think that what Alistair was mentioning about the sort of the this being an election that's probably going to be a lot about a ratification of the nuclear deal, sort of public ratification of it or not. I think that's a lot to do with the economy. It's a lot to do with the Iranian economy, which still hasn't really taken off, and they still haven't really seen the benefits from any sort of a nuclear deal. And in some ways, that's, I think, going to be the big determinant. I don't necessarily know that you're going to see, you know, these sorts of individuals, reformers or not. As you point out, the sort of spectrum that they're on is actually fairly narrow. You know, I don't think that's really going to be the big thing. I think the real question is going to be the economy. And if the economy hasn't really picked up and people haven't really seen the benefits that they were all promised were going to happen when they got past this nuclear logjam, that's really going to be the thing which is going to determine who ultimately is able to win in the election. Because whoever can sort of run a mandate which sounds like it's able to fix those problems, that's the person who I think the Supreme Leader will support. And I think that's the person who will win the public vote.
And this is where Trump comes in, because
exactly right.
Post-nuclear deal, it needs US investment because the dollar is big, but also it needs any foreign business doing or looking to do business in Iran will really kind of have to have the support of the US banks because, you know, the US banks, again, are
US
keen on this.
The US banking system, because if you don't get that, then you can't do any investments. If you can't get the money in there, well, you're never going to get the money out.
And as long as the US government sort of doesn't necessarily approve it, then everyone's going to be reluctant to invest. And as, this is a cycle that goes on. And the longer it goes on, people in Iran who were willing to take a leap with the nuclear deal are starting to think, actually, maybe we got it wrong. Yeah. Actually, we are not seeing, as you say, any benefit from this.
And there's also a danger, Rafa, that you could end up in a situation where the rhetoric between Iran and the US becomes quite heated again, particularly if Trump has words to say about Rouhani and Rouhani is worried that the economy isn't going his way. And as we see in elections all over the world, if the economy is not on your side, it doesn't hurt if you have a rhetorical enemy.
Well, exactly. And that's exactly it. I mean, the sort of American whipping boy in Iranian politics is an old tradition, right? It's a quick way of rallying people around the flag and you point to an enemy, and the United States makes a very inconvenient one. And I'm sure Donald Trump will say many things which will make him a very easy target for these for those sorts of accusations and those sorts of slogans.
Okay, we'll pause just for a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're back in a moment talking about China and North Korea.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Raffaella Pantucci and Alistair Bunkle. Let's turn to China now. It's almost time yet again for the annual World Economic Forum high up in the snowy mountains of Davos, Switzerland. It's the go-to schmoozing spot for the global elite. And next week, China's President Xi Jinping will join them, the first time a Chinese leader is attending. Raffaello, what's the message he's likely to be bringing to Davos?
Well, luckily, the People's Daily has published an op-ed telling us this, so we don't even need to speculate, you know. Apparently, he is going to come and be the torchbearer of the open trade system. And Mr. Xi's visit will boost the world's confidence in global governance. Which,
good.
If you think about it,
we do.
We need some of this after all the Trump discussion we've been having and all the other disasters. But if you think about it, isn't it somewhat strange that we're talking about the leader of a communist country, a closed communist country, coming to the sort of world's gathering of, you know, the ultimate plutocrat gathering to tell them all about sort of global trade and international relations and geopolitics? It's a sort of a very bizarre twist in many ways that we're now looking to someone like Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, to be the one who's going to help talk about a global trade, who's going to talk about relationships around the world, who's going to talk about the sort of open liberal economic system that we all ultimately benefit from. This is ultimately supposed to be the United States' role, you know, and the sort of idea that now they're looking to Xi Jinping to carry this banner is sort of an incredible kind of distortion of reality in some ways.
Alistair, I mean, part of that is part of what the People's Daily, I apologise to the fine upstanding journalists of the People's Daily about us, are saying here is nonsense, isn't it? Because it's, you know, Xi Jinping isn't that interested in open trade. He's interested in managed trade, which helps China. They don't want free trade.
And, of course, there is a gap in America, and Donald Trump, during Davos, will be sworn in as president. He has spoken about hiking tariffs against the Chinese. He has spoken about closing in and retreating from the world. And this is an opportunity for Xi Jinping as the Chinese premier to be seen on the sort of the world economic stage at the World Economic Forum. And it's not just about Xi Jinping. It's also the business delegation he's bringing with him as well. It is an opportunity for them to forge business links with the international world. And it's an opportunity for the international world to forge business links with China. you're right, China's a communist country, but it's kind of got its own sort of form of capitalism. And I just wonder whether or not this is a sort of...
Capitalism with communist characteristics.
It's capitalism with the smallest possible C. You know, this is just another stage, I suppose, in China being seen on a bigger economic platform, along with the people who believe that they are the masters of the world economies.
Do you think it is actually quite symbolic, Rafael, that Xi Jinping will be there, but the American president won't? And, you know, an American president who campaigned not just, you know, in terms of raising tariffs on Chinese imports, but was the most anti-free trade or, you know, international trade candidate they'd been in a generation or so.
Look, China's done really quite well out of the current global system. You know, the current global order as it's structured economically is one that they benefit from, you know, and they can see that. They can see that they've done very well out of the fact that they've been able to leverage the fact they've got this colossal market that everyone wants to get into and that can manufacture all this stuff at a very low cost to become really incredibly dominant and really do quite well and grow in the leaps and bounds. You know, the fact that you can talk about sort of China going from, you know, 8% growth per year to 7% growth per year, you know, figures that frankly any Western government would be ecstatic if they were getting and say, oh my God, this is hugely impactful in the world. I think shows how much power and how much strength and benefit they've really drawn from the current international system. So in some ways, it's very funny that the sort of country that was sort of built on an ideological foundation that sort of rejected this liberal order is in fact the one that's done fantastically well out of it. And in some ways, Xi Jinping going there is, I would argue, really a reflection of that and a reflection of the fact that that's a reality of the world that we sort of currently live in. I think what's going to be really interesting is to see how China reacts to President Trump, who looks like he's going in very much the opposite direction and trying to reshape this entire global order. And I think in some ways, him, you know, Xi Jinping going to Davos is a way to try to build links to the other plutocrats who do rule this sort of global trading order to show that, you know, I'm one of you. Our country is part of your system and wants to continue with this system because we're doing quite well out of it.
Okay, just finally, let's turn to North Korea. The US Defense Secretary Ash Carter said this week that the US military would shoot down any North Korean missile that posed a threat to the US or an ally. This comes after Kim Jong-un's New Year's message, which said the North was testing an ICBM capable of delivering a nuclear weapon to the US mainland. But Ash Carter has also said that if any particular missile launch doesn't pose a threat, it may be more advantageous to simply watch what happens to gather intelligence. Alistair Bunkle, are either of these or both of these strategies quite risky? Because first of all, even trying to shoot down a missile like that isn't that straightforward.
And if you miss, it looks pretty bad PR-wise. If you decide not to shoot it down, as you were saying, or as Ash Carter was saying, you can gather intelligence so you can watch its flight path, you can try and analyse what engines fuel it's using. If you can, it's not easy, but it's been done. If you can get to the site where it eventually comes down, you can perhaps recover some of the missile and you've got a treasure trove of intelligence. The fact is North Korea doesn't yet have an ICBM. It's never tested one, and until it does, and it's a hugely complex piece of science and equipment and very expensive, and you have to be able to exit the Earth's atmosphere and re-enter with a miniaturized nuclear warhead on board. It's not easy. It's a number of steps away, and I think until North Korea gets closer, I think, you know, we're still talking somewhere away yet. Although, what always concerns me is that they are heading in the right direction, unstopped.
And, Raffaello, if they're heading in the right direction unstopped, what can stop them?
I mean, this is a really good question because I think, you know, one of the things which you've seen, I mean, it's come up a bit. I mean, a lot of the sort of rhetoric and discussion around Trump is, and in the media has been this confrontation with racial media and the focus on Russia. But one thing which you'll see is consistently mentioned by sort of Obama administration people going out is they point to North Korea and say there's a problem that's going to come up very soon and is very difficult because there are no good options and there's no easy way to do it. I remember being in a discussion once with some officials, and they said the problem with North Korea is if you set them a red line, they run towards it. You know, and so it's very difficult. They've tried sanctions, they've tried to get the Chinese to lean on them, and the Chinese have leaned on them at various moments, but there's only so far they want to lean because they don't want the place to collapse. It's just there are no good options and no good ways to see how you actually deal with this problem.
But it does, Alistair, require a, or it seems to require, a decent relationship between China and the US, or at least them both pushing in the same direction.
Yeah, let me just, with a minute or so to go, let me try and bring together every single strand that we've spoken about in the last half an hour. Iran is an example of when dialogue works, you can get a nuclear deal. Having been to North Korea and studied it quite in depth, I just think that a dialogue with them is probably the next option that should be tested again. Having said that, you've got to be careful. It has been tested unsuccessfully, but it might be worth going there again. You've got to bring China on board. They are absolutely fundamental in this. If the conditions are right for China, then they will put the pressure on North Korea. I think give talking a go.
Okay, there we are. Give talking a go. It's like give peace a chance.
That's a really clumsy phrase.
No, it works.
Jaw is better than World War, right?
We'll end it there. Raffaele Pantucci, Alistair Bunkle, thank you both very much. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Guy Lutz and Helena Geriat. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We're back tomorrow, same time, 1800. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.